This is a special recording, The Count of Monte Cristo. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, my name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service. I will be reading for Harrison 2 from The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandra Dumas, translated and with an introduction and notes by Robin Buss. Chapter 8, The Chateau d'If. Crossing the antechamber, the commissioner of police gestured to two gendarmes, who took up their positions on either side of Dantès. A door leading from the chambers of the Crown Prosecutor to the law courts was opened, and they went along one of the long dark corridors that inspire a shudder in all who enter them, even when they have no cause to fear. Just as Villefort's chambers gave access to the Palais de Justice, so the Palais de Justice gave access to the prison, a somber pile overlooked by the bell tower of Les Écoles, which rises opposite and examines it with curiosity from every gaping aperture. After several twists and turns in the corridor down which they went, Dantès saw a door with an iron wicket open before him. The police commissioner knocked on it with a little hammer, and the three blows sounded to Dantès as though they had been struck against his heart. The door opened, and the two gendarmes gently pushed their prisoner forward, for he still hung back. Dantès crossed the awful threshold, and the door closed noisily behind him. He now breathed a different atmosphere, where the air was heavy and sulfurous. He was in prison. He was taken to a cell that was quite clean, despite the bars and locks. The appearance of his surroundings, consequently, did not arouse too much fear in him. In any case, the deputy prosecutor's words, spoken in tones that seemed to Dantès to express such concern, still echoed in his ears like a sweet promise of hope. It was already 4 o'clock when Dantès was led into his cell. As we have already mentioned, it was March the 1st, so the prisoner would soon be in darkness. His hearing became more acute as his sight dimmed, and, at the slightest sound which reached him, convinced that they were coming to set him free, he leapt up and took a step towards the door, but the noise soon faded as it vanished in another direction, and Dantès slumped back onto a stool. Finally, at around 10 o'clock in the evening, just as he was starting to lose hope, he heard a new sound that this time really did seem to be coming towards his cell. And indeed, there were steps in the corridor that halted in front of his door. A key turned in the lock. The bolts creaked, and the huge mass of oak moved open, suddenly filling the room with the dazzling light of two torches, in which Dantès could see the shining sabers and muskets of four gendarmes. He had taken two steps forward, but stopped in his tracks at the sight of this increased force. "Have you come for me?" he asked. "Yes," one of the gendarmes replied. "On behalf of Monsieur, the deputy crown prosecutor?" "I suppose so." "Very well," Dantès replied. "I am ready to go with you." Certain that it was Monsieur de Villefort who had sent for him, the unfortunate young man had no apprehension and went out calmly, with easy steps, to station himself between the soldiers who formed his escort. A carriage was waiting at the street door. The driver was on his seat, and there was a police officer sitting behind him. "Has this carriage come for me?" Dantès asked. "It's for you," one of the gendarmes replied. "Get in." Dantès wanted to say something, but the door opened and he felt a shove. He had neither the opportunity to resist nor any intention of doing so. At once he found himself seated inside the carriage between two gendarmes, while the two others took their place on the bench at the front, and the heavy vehicle began to move forward with a sinister rumble. The prisoner looked at the windows, which were barred. He had merely exchanged one prison for another, with the difference that this one was moving and taking him to some unknown destination. However, through the bars, which were so closely set that a hand could barely pass between them, Dantes could observe that they were proceeding down the Rue Casserie, then the Rue Saint-Laurent, and the Rue Taramy, heading towards the port. Soon, through his own bars and those of the monument beside which they had stopped, he saw the bright lights of the detention barracks. The carriage stopped. The police officer got down and went across to the guardroom. A dozen soldiers emerged and formed ranks. Dantes could see their rifles shining in the reflection from the dockside lamps. "Can it be for me," he wondered, "that they are deploying all these men?" The officer unlocked the door, and in doing so, answered his question without speaking a word, for Dantes could see that a path had been opened for him between the two lines of soldiers, leading down to the quayside. The two gendarmes who were sitting on the front bench got out first. Then he himself was taken out, followed by those who had been sitting beside him. They set off towards a dinghy that a boatman of the customs was holding against the quay by a chain. The soldiers watched Dantes go past with a look of dumb curiosity. In an instant, he was placed in the stern of the boat, still between the four gendarmes, while the officer stood in the bow. With a violent shudder, the boat was pushed away from the quay, and four oarsmen began to row vigorously towards the Pilon. At a cry from the boat, the chain across the entrance to the port was lowered, and Dantes found himself in the area known as the Friel, that is to say, outside the harbor. The prisoner's first reaction at finding himself outside had been one of joy. The open air was almost freedom. He drew deep breaths to fill his lungs with the sharp breeze that carries on its wings all the unknown perfumes of the night and the sea. Soon, however, he sighted they were rowing in front of the same reserve where he had been so happy that very morning in the hour before his arrest. And through two brightly lit windows, he could hear the merry sounds of a ball drifting towards him. He clasped his hands together, raised his eyes to heaven, and prayed. The boat continued on its way. It had passed by the Tête du Mort and was opposite the cove of the Faro. It was about to round the battery, and this Dantes could not understand. "But where are you taking me?" he asked one of the gendarmes. "You will know soon enough." "But even so, we are not allowed to tell you anything." Being half a soldier himself, Dantes knew that it was ridiculous to ask questions of subordinates who had been forbidden to reply, so he kept silent. However, the strangest ideas crowded through his brain. Since they could not go far in a boat of this size, and there was no ship at anchor in the direction towards which they were heading, he thought that they must be going to put him ashore on some distant part of the coast and tell him he was free. He was not bound, and no attempt had been made to handcuff him. This seemed like a good sign. In any case, had not the deputy prosecutor told him that, provided he did not mention the dread name of Noirtier, he had nothing to fear? Had not Villefort, in his very presence, destroyed the dangerous letter, which was the only proof they had against him? So he waited, silent and deep in thought, trying to penetrate the blackness of night with his sailor's eye, accustomed to darkness and familiar with space. On their right, they had left behind the Isle Ratonneau with its lighthouse, and almost following the line of the coast, they had arrived opposite the bay of the Catalans. Here, the prisoner looked with still greater intensity. Here, Mercedes, lived, and he felt at every instant that he could see the vague and ill-defined shape of a woman on the dark shore. Was it possible that Mercedes had been warned by some presentiment that her lover was going by, only 300 yards away? There was only one light burning in the Catalan village. By studying its position, Dantes realized that it came from his fiancée's room. Mercedes was the only person still awake in the whole of the little colony. If the young man were to shout loudly, his fiancée might hear him. But a false feeling of shame prevented him. What would these men who were watching him say if he cried out like a madman? So he stayed silent, staring at the light. Meanwhile, the boat continued on its way, but the prisoner was not thinking about the boat. He was thinking about Mercedes. The light disappeared behind a small hill. Dantes turned around and noticed that they were making for the open sea. While he had been looking ashore, taken up with his thoughts, sails had been substituted for the oars, and the boat was now being driven before the wind. Despite his reluctance to ask the gendarme any further questions, Dantes moved over to him and took his hand. "Comrade," he said, "in the name of your conscience and as a soldier, I beg you to have pity on me and to give me an answer. I am Captain Dantes, a good and loyal Frenchman, even though I have been accused of I know not what act of treason. Where are you taking me? Tell me, and I swear as a sailor that I will answer to the call of duty and resign myself to my fate." The gendarme scratched his ear and looked at his fellow. The latter made a sign that roughly indicated, "Since we have gone this far, I see no objection," and the gendarme turned back to Dantes. "You are a Masaile and a sailor, and you ask me where we are going?" "Yes, because, on my honor, I don't know." "You haven't guessed?" "Not at all." "That's not possible." "I swear by all that is most sacred to me in the world. I beg you, tell me." "What about my instructions?" "Your instructions do not forbid you to inform me of something that I shall know in 10 minutes, or half an hour, or perhaps an hour. Yet, between now and then, you can spare me centuries of uncertainty. I ask this of you as though you were my friend. Look, I am not trying to resist or to escape. In any case, it would be impossible. Where are we going?" "Unless you are blindfolded, or you have never been outside the port of Marseille, then you must surely guess where we are going." "No." "But look around you." Dantes got up and naturally turned his eyes to the point towards which the boat appeared to be heading. Some 200 yards in front of them loomed the sheer black rock from which, like a flinty excrescence, rises the Chateau d'If. To Dantes, who had not been thinking about it at all, the sudden appearance of this strange shape, this prison shrouded in such deep terror, this fortress, which for 3 centuries had nursed Marseille with its gloomy legends, had the same effect as the spectacle of the scaffold on a condemned man. "My God," he cried, "the Chateau d'If! Why are we going there?" The gendarme smiled. "You can't be taking me to incarcerate me there," Dantes continued. "The Chateau d'If is a state prison, meant only for major political criminals. I haven't committed any crime." "Are there examining magistrates or any other sort of judges in the Chateau d'If?" "As far as I know, only a governor, jailers, a garrison, and a solid wall." "Come now, my friend, don't be so surprised, or I think you are showing your gratitude for my indulgence by making fun of me." Dantes grasped the gendarme's arm with crushing force. "Are you telling me, then, that I am to be taken to the Chateau d'If To be imprisoned there? Seems like it, said the gendarme. But in any case, my friend, it won't do you any good to grip my hand so tightly. Without any further inquiry or formalities? The young man asked. The formalities have been gone through and the inquiry made. Like that, despite Monsieur de Villefort's promise? I don't know what Monsieur de Villefort promised you, said the gendarme. All I do know is that we're going to the Chateau d'If. Hey there, what are you doing? Hold on. Give me a hand here. With a movement as swift as lightning, though not swift enough, even so, to escape the gendarme's practiced eye, Dantès tried to leap overboard, but was held back just as his feet left the planks of the boat, into which he fell back, screaming furiously. Fine, the gendarme explained, kneeling on his chest. Fine. So that is how you to keep your word as a sailor. Still waters run deep. Well now, my good friend, make a single movement, just one, and I'll put a shot in your head. I disobeyed my first instruction, but I guarantee you that I shall not fail to abide by the second. He gave every indication of his intention to carry out his threat, lowering his musket until Dantès could feel the barrel pressing against his temple. For an instant, he considered making the forbidden movement and so putting a violent end to the misfortune that had swooped down and suddenly seized him in its vulture's grip. But precisely because the misfortune was not so unexpected, Dantès felt that it could not be long-lasting. Then he remembered Monsieur de Villefort's promises. And finally, it must be admitted that death in the bilge of an open boat at the hands of a gendarme struck him as ugly and grim. So he fell back onto the planks of the vessel with a cry of rage, gnawing at his fists in his fury. Almost at the same moment, the boat shook violently. One of the oarsmen leapt on the rock that had just struck against its prow. A rope groaned as it unwound from a pulley, and Dantès realized that they had arrived and the skiff was being moored. His guards, holding him simultaneously by his arms and the collar of his jacket, forced him to get up, obliged him to go ashore, and dragged him towards the steps leading up to the gate of the fortress, while the officer took up the rear, armed with a musket and bayonet. In any case, Dantès did not attempt to struggle pointlessly. His slowness was the result of inertia rather than resistance. He stumbled dizzily like a drunken man. Once more, he could see his soldiers lined up along the steep embankment. He felt the steps obliging him to lift his feet and noticed that he was passing beneath a gateway and that the gate was closing behind him. But all of this in a daze, as if through a mist, without clearly perceiving anything. He could no longer even distinguish the sea, that vast sorrow of prisoners who stare into space with the awful feeling that they are powerless to cross it. There was a momentary pause, during which he tried to gather his wits. He looked around him. He was in a square courtyard enclosed within four high walls. He could hear the slow, regular footfalls of the sentries, and each time they passed in front of the two or three reflections cast on the walls by the light of as many lamps burning into the castle, it reflected on the muzzles of their guns. They waited there for about 10 minutes. Certain that Dantès could not escape, the gendarmes had released their hold on him. They appeared to be waiting for orders, which eventually came. "Where is the prisoner?" asked a voice. "Here," one of the gendarmes replied. "Let him follow me. I'll conduct him to his cell." "Come on," the gendarme said, shoving Dantès forward. The prisoner followed his guide, who led him into a room that was nearly underground, its bare, dripping walls seemingly impregnated with a vapor of tears. A species of lamp on a wooden stool, its wick drowning in fetid oil, lit the shining walls of this appalling abode and showed Dantes his guide, a sort of subordinate jailer, poorly dressed and coarse-featured. "Here is your room for tonight," he said. "It is late, and the governor has gone to bed. Tomorrow, when he wakes up and can examine his instructions concerning you, he may move you elsewhere. Meanwhile, here is some bread. You have water in that jar, and straw over there in the corner. That is all a prisoner can want. Good night to you." Before Dantes could open his mouth to reply, let alone see where the jailer was putting the bread, or the place where the jar stood, and look over to the corner where the straw was waiting to make him a bed, the jailer had taken the lamp and, shutting the door, denied the prisoner even the dim light that had shown him, as though in a flash of lightning, the streaming walls of his prison. So he found himself alone in the silence and darkness, as black and noiseless as the icy cold of the vaults, which he could feel pressing down on his feverish brow. When the first rays of dawn started to bring a little light into this den, the jailer returned with orders to leave the prisoner where he was. Dantes had not moved. An iron hand seemed to have nailed him to the very spot where he had stopped the night before. Only his deep-set eyes were now hidden behind the swelling caused by the moisture of his tears. He was motionless, staring at the floor. He had spent the whole night in this way, standing and not sleeping for an instant. The jailer came over to him and walked around him, but Dantes appeared not to notice. He tapped him on the shoulders, and Dantes shuddered and shook his head. "Haven't you slept?" asked the jailer. "I don't know," Dantes replied. The jailer looked at him in astonishment. "Aren't you hungry?" "I don't know," Dantes replied again. "Do you want anything?" "I want to see the governor." The jailer shrugged his shoulders and went out. Dantes looked after him, stretched his hands out towards the half-open door, but it was closed again. At this, his chest seemed to have been torn apart by a profound sob. The tears that filled it burst out like two streams. He fell down, pressed his face to the ground, and prayed for a long time, mentally going through the whole of his past life and wondering what crime he had committed in so brief a span that could merit such cruel punishment. So the day was spent. He ate hardly more than a few mouthfuls of bread and drank a few drops of water. At times he remained seated, wrapped in thought. At others, he paced around his prison like a wild animal trapped in an iron cage. One thought struck him with particular force. It was this, that during the crossing, when not knowing where they were taking him, he had remained so calm and docile. There had been a dozen times when he could have jumped overboard, and once in the water, thanks to an ability that made him one of the most skillful divers in Marseille, have vanished beneath the waves, evaded his captors, reached the shore, fled, hidden in some deserted bay, waited for a Genoese or Catalan ship, gone to Italy or Spain, and from there written to Mercedes to join him. As for a livelihood, he had no misgivings in any country. Good sailors are everywhere in short supply. He spoke Italian like a Tuscan, and Spanish like a son of old Castile. He would have lived in freedom, happy, with Mercedes and with his father, because his father would come to join them. Yet here he was, a prisoner, shut up in this impregnable fortress in the Chateau d'If, not knowing what had become of his father or what had become of Mercedes, and all because he trusted Villefort's word. Dantes thought he would go mad, and he rolled in fury on the fresh straw that his jailer had brought him. The following day, at the same hour, the jailer came in. "Well," he asked, Are you in a more reasonable frame of mind than yesterday? Dante did not answer. Come now, pull yourself together. Is there anything you need that I can get you? Tell me.
I want to speak to the governor.
Pah, the jailer said impatiently. I've already told you that's impossible.
Why is it impossible?
Because under the prison regulations, a prisoner is not allowed to make that request.
And what is allowed here? Dantes asked.
Better food if you pay, walks, and sometimes books. I have no need of books, I have no desire to walk, and my food suits me well. So there is only one thing I want, which is to see the governor.
If you get on my nerves by repeating the same thing over and over, said the jailer, I shall stop bringing you any food at all.
Well then, said Dantes, if you do not bring me anything to eat, I shall starve. The tone of Dante's voice, as he said this, showed the jailer that his prisoner would be happy to die. And, as every prisoner, when all is said and done, represents roughly 10 sous a day for his jailer, the man considered the loss that he would suffer from Dante's death and continued in milder vein.
Listen, what you want is impossible. Don't ask for it again. It is unheard of for the governor to come into a cell at a prisoner's request. But behave well, and you will be allowed to exercise. And one day, while you are in the exercise yard, the governor may go by. Then you can talk to him. It is his business whether he wishes to reply.
But how long, Dantes asked, am I likely to wait before this occurs?
Who knows? A month? 3 months? 6? Perhaps a year?
That's too long, said Dantes. I want to see him at once.
Oh, don't get obsessed by one single thing that is impossible to obtain. Otherwise, in a fortnight, you'll be mad.
Do you think so?
Quite mad. That is always how madness begins. We have an example right here. It was because he kept on offering 1,000,000 francs to the governor if he would set him free, that the abbé, who occupied the cell before you went off, his head.
How long is it since he left the cell?
2 years.
And he was freed?
No.
Put in a dungeon.
Listen, Dante said, I am not an abbé, nor am I mad.
Perhaps I shall become so. But alas, for the moment, I have all my wits. I want to make another suggestion to you.
What?
I won't offer you 1,000,000 because I could not give it to you. But if you want, I shall offer you 100 écus so that next time you cross to Marseille, you will go to the Catalans and give a letter to a young woman called Mercedes. Not even a letter. Just a couple of lines.
If I were to carry 2 lines and I was caught, I shall lose my job, which is worth 1,000 livres a year, without food and bonuses. So you can see I would be a fine fool if I were to risk losing 1,000 livres to make 300.
Well, Dante said, listen to me and mark what I say. If you refuse to carry 2 lines to Mercedes, or at least to let her know that I am here, I shall wait for you one day, hiding behind my door, and as soon as you enter, crack your head open with this stool.
Threats, the jailer exclaimed, taking a step back and putting himself on his guard. You really are losing your mind. The abbé started the same way. In 3 days, you will be raving mad, as he is.
Luckily, there are dungeons in the Chateau d'If. Dantes took the stool and swung it around his head.
Very well, said the jailer. Since you insist, it will be reported to the governor.
At last, Dantes said, putting the stool down on the floor and sitting on it. wild-eyed, hanging his head, as if he had truly become insane. The jailer left, and a moment later returned with three soldiers and a corporal. "By order of the governor," he said, "take this prisoner to the floor below."
"You mean to the dungeons?" said the corporal.
"To the dungeons. The mad must go with the mad." The four soldiers seized Dantes, who fell into a sort of catatonia, and followed them without trying to resist. He was led down 15 steps, and they opened the door of a dungeon, which he entered, muttering, "Quite correct. The mad must go with the mad." The door closed, and Dantes walked straight ahead, his arms outstretched until he touched the wall. Then he sat down in a corner and remained motionless, while his eyes, gradually becoming accustomed to the gloom, started to make out his surroundings. The jailer had been right. Dantes was very close to madness. We've run out of time for this hour of The Count of Monte Cristo by Alexandra Dumas, translated by Robin Buss. We'll pick up right where we left off in the next episode. My name is Kelly Wall from North Carolina Reading Service, providing news and information for individuals who are blind or print impaired. Our website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or concerns, please call 919-832-5138.